Hello, everyone. This is Regan from Better, Faster, Further, sitting down today for our third podcast. They've gone quick so far. I can't believe we're at number three. We literally just started, but I look forward to continuing the momentum that we've built so far. Today, I am with our esteemed colleague, Adam Odosky, who joined me for the first two podcasts discussing his preparation and kind of post race debrief of the Moab 240. And we spent a lot of time talking about facing adversity and overcoming obstacles and some of the mindsets and behaviors associated with that. And Adam, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Regan. If it's any indication to how recovery is going, I did put my name on the wait list for two 200s next year and reached out to Destination Trails about trying to somehow figure out a way to get into the Triple Crown. So that in and of itself, I guess, will tell you how recovery is going or my level of sanity.
Yeah, I was going to say that may speak more volumes to other aspects of your life than just the recovery part. But that's awesome. And we will continue to keep everybody apprised of just any of the cool stuff that folks on our team are doing. But that's just amazing. Congrats, Adam. Well done there. And I'm super excited to have my co-founder and co-managing partner of Better, Faster, Further, Mr. Louis Selincourt, joining us today. This is his first time on the podcast, and we're excited to have him. So, Louis, good morning, and how are you?
Hey, guys. I'm great, and thanks for finally inviting me to the party. I'm excited to be here to chit-chat with you, to share some stories, and get involved in this this experience.
That's awesome. Well, we're looking forward to diving in. And I happen to be in Marin County in Northern California. Adam, where are you today?
I'm still hiding out in the mountains of Salida, Colorado.
Is it snowing yet?
Actually, it is, as I look out the window. Yep, it is snowing a little bit, but Snowline is not quite in town yet, but it's coming. I think by tomorrow, I'll have snow on the ground.
Yeah, my family was saying it was snowing in Durango, or at least sprinkling there earlier in the week. And Louie, you're in like Earthquakeville, huh?
Yeah, I was going to mention that. I'm down in San Jose on the southeast side of San Jose. As you go down 101 and you just sort of think you're out of San Jose, look up on the left and there's some hills. And that's where I am. And yesterday, we had a 5.1 earthquake, followed a few minutes later by a 3.1, followed about an hour or two later by, I think it was a 3.2. So I guess by big earthquake standards, none of those are huge. However, I was sitting here on a Zoom call in my home office at the time, and my screen started rocking, my camera rocked, and the person I was Zooming with actually said they felt like they were in the earthquake themselves. Maybe it was actually a little worse with the camera swinging around. But the interesting thing, and we may get to talk about, you know, my running hobbies too, but the epicenter of the earthquake, which was just a few miles away up in the hills next to my house, is exactly, not similar or close by, but is exactly the spot that I run at. And maybe someone listening to this can actually educate me, but I'm fascinated to know if I was actually running that day across the epicenter, what would that have felt like? Is the epicenter calm and the rumbles and the shaking is felt further away? Or at that epicenter, would I have been running and just knocked off my feet to the ground? I'd love to know the answer to that.
Yeah, I'm sure somebody could tell us. If anybody's out there listening to this and has a good answer, let us know. But that's a good little research project. We should figure that out. And it is crazy. It's a good reminder. I mean, we in California talk about it a lot, but it's been a long time since we've had like a legit earthquake, and everyone says we're due. But these are those little reminders that terra firma is all relative, right?
So. Yeah, this is the biggest one here in this area since 2007. So, going to be a lot of aftershocks, they said.
Yep, that's amazing. Well, Louis, you have a storied history and a unique background. And, you know, in the first podcast, we shared a bit of my background and Adam's background, and then obviously talked about the Moab 240 and some of the race and adversity. But I'd love to take a good chunk of today's session and you know, give folks an opportunity to get to know you a bit better. I think, you know, the Better Faster Further, the company that Louis and I co-founded, is truly a combination and a marriage, if you will, of our different backgrounds. And Louis couldn't be more different than me in many, many ways. We share a lot of the same values and perspectives on things, but our life story and our backgrounds and our work experience is polar opposite. And you know, we think that some of Better Faster Further's secret sauce is that difference. And Louis and I get along famously. We joke around a lot. We give each other grief and you know, about age, about looks, about experience and such. And but it's been a total pleasure to get to build this company with you, and obviously adding more and more humans to it. Luna Ranjo and Adam and Rachel and the Rachels and Irene and all the folks. It's been awesome. And I hope to get them on here at some point, either individually or you know, as a group. But I want to give you some space just to tell us your background. And, you know, I think we kind of start from the beginning, because that leads to just a very unique journey to coming to the U.S. and doing the work that you did, and then helping kind of co-found Better Faster Further and bring us up to date today. So I'll give you the mic for a bit, and we'll chime in and give you grief along the way.
I look forward to the grief. I wouldn't expect anything less. Yeah, my history started a long time ago in a very far away place. So I grew up in Northwest London, and it was a good childhood. You know, I guess you would classify me as middle class, maybe lower middle class. I'm not quite sure. I didn't really know the difference in those days. But I was fortunate. I had a mother and a father, and I have one sibling, a sister who still lives locally in the UK. And I went to the local school that was a walking distance from the house that we lived in Northwest London. And I'd walk to school every day. I remember it was really cold in the winter. The weather in England was always very unpredictable. You never could quite plan a party indoors or outdoors, because you never knew what the weather was going to be like. But it was a happy childhood. In general, I would say that schooling was always tough for me. When I was in about 8 or 9 years old, I remember at school one time that I wasn't quite getting it as quickly as some of the other kids. And I can remember I had a teacher. I can visualize her now. She used to wear long one-piece dresses down to her ankles, and she had white hair and glasses. Her name was Mrs. Austin. And there was one time in particular that I remember it vividly to this day, and it didn't all make sense to me until maybe 15 years ago or so. But when I was 8 or 9 years old, she screamed at me and she said, "Selincourt, are you stupid? Do you not get it? Why are you not working hard enough? Everybody else gets it. Go stand in the corner, face the corner, don't turn around. And when you're ready to work and put some effort in, come back."
That's like, and I remember, you know, cartoons of kids with a dunce cap, like faced in the corner. I thought, you know, you think it's a joke, but it's like for real.
Yeah, no, I felt ashamed. I don't recall actually if I cried or not, but probably did. But I know I felt ashamed and I felt confused. I felt that, you know what, I was trying as hard as I could try. You know, I'm even getting tearful thinking about it, the experience of it back then. So maybe I did cry. But I went and stood in the corner and I waited and waited and waited, and I had nothing to give in terms of explanation. So I had to wait until it came around to the lunch break and she told me that I could go out to lunch. I just had to try harder. And I had experiences like that a lot in Mrs. Austin's class, and she'd frequently shout at me. It felt like she picked on me, but I went through school and, I finished that school, and then I went to the equivalent in England of high school. And at high school, my parents had a prestigious school that they hoped I would go to. And you could, in the UK at that time, put your choice of first, second, and third school to go to. And I think my folks were doing what they believed the best for me was. But the first, second, and third choice school was the same school. They put the same choice down as 1, 2, 3. I think for increased probability that I get into that school. Mm. There was an entrance exam, And I took the entrance exam, and all I know is I failed. And, you know, I've had cute stories in the past where people figure, oh, yeah, you never wanted to go there. You must have, you know, failed it on purpose. And I'm like, yeah, sure. I think I tried. I think I tried reasonably well, but I failed. At that point, we were stuck because the first, second, and third choice was the school that didn't want to have me. So I felt a little disappointed. I had some friends that were going to that school. So I went to another school, which was pretty much in downtown, close to downtown London, Camden Town, for those folks that know Camden Town. And it was quite a ways from my house. I had to walk to the train station, depending on the time of day, take one or two trains, and then depending on the day, take a bus ride or walk the rest of the way. So it was quite a hike to get to the school that my parents wanted me to go to secondarily and would have me. It was a last minute admission because we were in a bit of a, we were stuck, but the academic qualifications at that school are a lot lower than others. I went through the school. It was not known for its academics. It was more known for its sports. At that time, I wasn't really very sporty. I can remember times at school where I did okay in the classes. I guess you would say I was a struggling C-level student. I just about passed my classes. And when it got to the sports, which the school was strong at, swimming wasn't one of my strengths. I remember a swimming teacher one time, we were all in the deep end of the pool hanging on the edge. And Mr. Walsh, I remember these names here imprinted in my brains. Mr. Walsh held out a long stick with a big hoop at the end in the deep end and shouted something called grab the hoop. It was in the middle of the deep end, so I had to let go to grab it, and I couldn't swim very well. And the whole class was watching. They're all hanging on. They're all jeering me on. I told him I thought he was going to move it. He said he wasn't going to. I jumped for it. He moved it. I flapped around in the deep end and managed to scupper back to the side and held on. And I can remember my heart was going like this. It was pounding away. To this day, I don't really swim very well and don't have a lot of confidence. I think that had something to do with it. But, you know, I had some good friendships at the school. I enjoyed the people I met there. A number of them I still know today, and we stay in touch, even though it's in London, which is far away from where I live today. When it came to other sports, you know, it was the usual thing. Soccer, as we call it in America, football was the most popular sport. And I don't know how it was for you all, but when it came to choosing the teams, it was usually, you know, people chose their favorite players to go on each team. And then I was pretty accustomed to it. It was, okay, one guy left standing. That's selling court. Well, we had him last week, so it's your turn to have him this week. And I kind of, you know, got used to it, and I walked over to that side with my head down, knowing that I was the booby prize. I was the one that nobody wanted. I got to graduation, and I took my graduation tests. In those days, there were things called CSEs or O-levels, and I felt pretty good. I felt pretty good about how I did in my exams. I had an accommodation. I had an operation on my right wrist at the time to remove something growing inside my wrist. That's my writing hand. And they gave me an extra 30 minutes on my tests. So I felt pretty good about my graduation. I wrote down on a piece of paper and put it in a white envelope what I thought my results would be. And I kept it in my bedroom at home. And that white envelope scenario is something I refer back to later, because it's something that we do in business now these days too. But I predicted what I thought I was going to get, and I couldn't be more wrong. I gave myself some C's with a couple of B's, thinking, eh, it's not bad. I failed to graduate high school, and they wouldn't allow me to graduate, and I had to retake. I never really showed anyone what was in my white envelope. Or this is probably even the first time I told that story. But, you know, I thought, okay, I retook. I failed the second time. And at this point, my school was getting a little frustrated with me. I wasn't able to graduate. I needed to get out of there. And for the third time, my parents paid extra money to go to a different school district, which had a different syllabus similar, but it's run by a different education body. And for that one, that was the Associated Education Body Board, AEB. And they passed me barely. I just about scraped through to graduate. So, okay, I didn't do so well at school, but I felt like I'd learned some good, maybe life lessons there.
How old are you at this point?
Oh, at this point, I was 16 years old, I think, thereabouts. 16.
And just out of curiosity, what were some of those life lessons that you learned then that maybe you still use today?
I think that I learned to be resilient, to maybe not take things too personally and to heart, to understand that some people are angry inside and it's not me, it's them. Mm-hmm. I thought of that with Mrs. Austin. I thought of that with the kids that would choose me last at the soccer lineup, where they could have easily chose somebody else or made me feel good and choose me first one time, knowing they'd probably end up with me anyway that week. But they were just too fulfilled in their own selves and weren't really sensitive enough to me and my needs. Mm. I did go on. My parents, in their wisdom, sent me to community college to do an advanced degree in pure math and applied math, and this new thing that was called computers. And I thought that was ridiculous. I mean, I struggled to graduate high school and courses dedicated on pure and applied math. That was seemed nuts. This computer thing seemed interesting. My parents sent me to extra math tuition at somebody's house. This gentleman turned out to be a professor at the University of London teaching computers. He would teach me math. And then while I'm waiting for my parents to pick me up from his house, he would talk about this computer thing. And it kind of sounded fascinating. And I was really interested. And I remember sitting there waiting for them to show up while he was telling me about it. And it was really interesting. And at college, I could actually go ahead and practice some of this. And I want to be clear what computers were in those days. And it's kind of scary. I see there's a computer museum in Mountain View, California here.
Yeah.
And there they have some old black and white pictures of guys in black pants, white button-down shirts, and black ties working at these big, huge computers. I worked on the generations of computers before those. And this is like what you see in the history books as being really old. But in the times when I started working on computers back then, it was pre-screens, pre-cathode ray tubes. It was, you started the computer up by bootstrapping ones and zeros. And you had to flip the switches. If you get one byte wrong, it wouldn't start. And the point of the ones and zeros and the bootstrap is just so it can understand how to read the magnetic tape that would be pulled in by vacuum so that it had enough to know how to boot the rest of the computer up. So everything was extremely manual. And I'm very grateful for those experiences because computers today are internally based upon the same architectures and the same knowledge. So if you ask about lessons learned, I learned about the fundamentals of computers, the binary, octal, and decimal ways of thinking that I could then understand internals of computers that today it's just levels of abstractions of what mm-hmm. we had back in the 60s and 70s and the very beginnings of computers. And I advanced on to cards that were punched or paper tape, long strips of tape that had little holes in. And I remember the days where you'd drop one card and you'd mess up the program, or you'd have the paper tape and you have to punch new holes in it because it maybe got ripped or chewed up by the system when you put it in. So I worked on the old IBM, I think 360 series was the first ones that I worked on. And other brands and other computers. It was a good time. But you know what? That was at college. I never made it out of the first semester. I was, again, failing my exams. It got to the examination time, and I just didn't remember everything the teachers told me, or I didn't know how to answer the questions. And it was becoming clear, although, Adam, you asked about lessons, it was becoming clear then that I wasn't like the other kids. They seemed to hear it, know it. It was like the teacher would be at the front of the room giving a whole load of facts, and everybody, all the students are like sponges absorbing all of these facts. It got to exam time and you'd squeeze the sponge and all these facts would come out and go back on the exam paper or the ones that were needed. And when it came to the exam time for me, I'd like, God, that was a lot of information. I don't remember when we talked about that. So clearly this education system wasn't working for me. So after one semester, I was convinced, you know what, schooling's maybe not the right way to go. I better go get a job, some job. This computer thing fascinated me. I saw an advert, literally an advert in the back of the newspaper, in print, for a job at a company that was not that far away from where I lived, for a night shift computer operator. And I'm like, okay, you know, they said you needed a college degree. Well, it clearly wasn't me. But I wrote a resume up, CV as we call it in England. And I went for the interview thinking, I'm going to get some interview experience. And that's a good thing. I went into the interview. I sat there. The guy asked me questions. I gave him answers. At the end of the meeting, he said, you're hired. Huh. And I was like, amazed. I asked him later, why did you hire me? He goes, I just knew you were the right guy for the job. You know, I have a guess that this was a night shift. It was like midnight to 6 a.m. or something. It was minimum wage. And there was no other suckers out there that were willing to take that job and do
He's like, so you got it because you're the only one that actually showed up to the interview.
Yeah, thanks, Regan. I was at least the better of one of two, but yeah, maybe I was the only one that showed up.
Yeah, I think that's important to note, though. I mean, I love that story, actually, that, you know, if you're the one willing and able to step forward, even if it's uncomfortable, I mean, I think that is another maybe lesson learned and that applies today. It's that, you know, sometimes we have to do things that are just uncomfortable in order to get to the place that we want to get to.
And I think another lesson for me there was you just got to go for it. Yeah. I was not qualified for that job based upon what I read in the newspaper ad. I didn't have a college degree.
Yeah,
I knew a little bit about computers from talking to my tutor and from my one semester at college. But I wasn't really qualified, but I figured, hey, what have I got to lose? It's some interview practice. So I went for it. I worked night shift there and I was in the machine room, which was a cold room protected by freon gas that, you know, if anything went off, you had to run out before you got poisoned. It was all raised floors, very cold. And I was often the only one there. And thinking about it now, I think there were some attributes that I realize now that really helped me do well at that job. Firstly, I figured out if I'm going to work from midnight till like, you know, 6 a.m. in the morning or something, I don't be running around all night. So I got organized. In my first few hours of the night shift, I'd work like crazy to get things organized. And if I got things set up, I knew which tapes were going to be called. I preloaded the paper in the printers. I segmented the memory space out so it fitted the jobs that I needed to run. I did it all in the early part so that everything ran smoothly later. And you know what? That same guy that offered me the job, I spent a lot of time sitting at his desk in his chair with my feet up on the table, relaxing and reading and hanging out, etc., because the machine room was running in a neat, organized, pre-planned way. And it helped me to think about these things and make them neat and tidy. And I'll talk more about that in a little bit, I think. But you know what? One of the things I did, I was really getting fascinated by computers. And I would get a little bored and I would sit down and I would look around the computer. I'd look inside files. And I'd occasionally leave a Louis was here kind of thing. And the next day I'd go back to that file and I'd see my Louis was here was deleted. So I'd go back and I'd put it there and I'd put it somewhere else. And I'd go back the next day and I'd see it was being deleted. And I'm like, huh, what's going on here?
You drop little Easter eggs in there and someone was finding them?
I did. I didn't know it, but I might've been one of the first computer hackers that there were out there, leaving these little cookie crumbs and things. And there's some things that I did that I probably won't say on here because this will be recorded on some Bitbucket forever more. So I'm not going to mention it. But yeah, it was fun. I would leave things. And then what I came to realize later was the systems guys who worked on the next floor up, I was only on the, in the at the first floor level, they worked upstairs, were getting frustrated with security because they were realizing that I was able to hack in. And I put things there, no, just because I was curious and I was learning. So probably a year into that job, they invited me to work on the day shift, I think, so they could give me, so they could have better eyes on me and know what I was doing. There were other people around. I wasn't on my own sometimes because it got pretty creepy, to be honest, there on your own in the middle of the night. And then they invited me to join the systems group, and I became an engineer. Well, back then we called it a programmer, but these days we call it an engineer. And I went through that side of the business. But it was kind of fun. To fast forward how my career went from there, I started working as a programmer. I was programming code. I'd often have a bit of a dispute with my chief programmer. I'd write code that was really easy to understand, easy to maintain. A lot of my labels in my programs were girls' names. I was young at that age. It was easy for me to remember the girls' names of, you know, go here, go there, loop back to this girl's name. And it was simple that I had names of people, but he would get frustrated that my code wasn't efficient enough. I wasn't thinking in multi-dimensional arrays in the way that I should, because it would be more efficient and effective. Back in those days, CPU cycles, memory was at a premium. Again, there was a lesson in there that I wrote things the way that I can understand that made them easy for me, but it wasn't the most efficient coding. I started to use software that was owned by American companies, and I would often call them up and ask questions. I had a lot of questions, a lot of advocacy for what I needed to know. And even to this day, my kids make fun of how many questions I have, and they're sometimes embarrassed by my questioning. Mm-hmm. But it was, again, a lesson there that I'll come back to. And eventually, the American companies kept asking me, well, do you want a job? You're calling support up every day with these questions. We don't always know the answers. Maybe you should come work here. I think you'll be less of a problem if you work for us answering the phones than calling us up. And after being asked by so many different American companies, I think there was five opportunities that I had that I kept saying no to. But in the end, it felt like, you know what? This is just meant to be. I'm meant to move to America and work for a US software company. And I had personal reasons in terms of relationships, where I was, etc. One offer came along to move to the US for a company that was quite small and startup-ish. I'd worked for them in the UK. I actually didn't accept the first time. And 6 months later, after a whole load of my work buddies went to work there, I talked to them again. And the second time I joined them, it was a little company that we know now as Oracle. And I joined Oracle when we were a young, really relatively young startup in the region of $200-300 million. And I joined in the support center. I was basically answering phones. Back in those days, Oracle was small enough that we would literally run around the room when a phone rang to pick it up. But you didn't quite know which phone was going to ring on which desk. But that was the support line that people would ring up on. And I'd pick up the phone, and Oracle's thing there was we worked on 100 different operating systems and platforms because there weren't really the established ones at those points. And everybody was recruited for their skill in a particular one. But I'd pick up the phone and it may not be the one that I knew. And back then, our manuals were on paper. So the trick was you'd have to run across the room, pick up the phone, hope it was your operating system that you knew something about. But if it wasn't, you carried on because the person who knew that one might be on another phone. And then you have to stretch over, get the book, get the manual, and turn the pages really quietly. Because if they hear you turning the pages, are you just reading the manual like I'm reading the manual? So we'd have to turn it quietly. But it was a great learning experience back in the very early days. And, you know, you try and help as best you can. Back to the fundamentals of computers, doesn't matter what the operating system is, they're all based upon the same basics. Computers work on ones and zeros and compilers and machine code, and all this is all very similar. So if you understand the basics, it's pretty easy to think through and figure out how things work to this day. And this was quite some time. My career to this point has spanned 42 years, maybe 43 years. I'll have to count. Next year's probably 43 years.
We lose track of time after 40 something, you know.
It gets to be a long time. But I'm fortunate in that time, I've been a CEO, I've been a COO, I've been a general manager of businesses. I've worked in training, education, internal consultant, external consultant, product marketing, product management, marketing communications, and I could go on. I feel like I've had a good breadth of experiences. And that was somewhat by design. And again, back to the way I think things through, and I'll focus on that in a minute. I think it's difficult for me to go really deep and be the expert on anything, the world's leading expert, but understanding the breadth of things and how things work and how things fit together has been really important for me. And on reflection, I think that's been one of the advantages that I've been able to have, because I can take the experiences from whether it be a startup that I've worked in with two or three people or a teams of thousands of people that I've managed and led. It's the curiosity that I've had of how do things work, how do things hang together. To wrap up the story a little bit, I will say that just in recent times, maybe, like I say, 15 years ago, perhaps, maybe 18, I forget the exact number, but I came to learn that one of my children had a learning difficulty. And these days, there was a struggle for them graduating between years at school here in the US. We had an educational psychologist evaluate them. My wife and I went to the diagnosis meeting where they delivered the results of what my child's challenges were in learning. And I tell you, that must have been one of the most emotional meetings I've had, because as I heard the diagnosis of what their learning difficulties were, the educational and child psychologist was describing me. Even though it was my child, it was describing me and what I went through with Mrs. Austin and Mr. Walsh and the different challenges I had through my working career. I realized that I don't learn the same way as other people. I don't have the same mental capacity to think things through. And it doesn't make me any worse than anyone else or any more stupid than anyone else. I'm just different. Like my child's different. And I'll tell you, that particular child, if you're wondering, I have three beautiful children, all adults in the real world now, working, doing their thing. This particular one ended up going to normal high school, four-year college, graduating in four-year college, and has a great career ahead of him now. But for me, I didn't get that advantage of having it diagnosed while I was at school. I had to figure my way around. And I've learned that advocacy was really important, even though I didn't know it. Asking questions, as I mentioned, I ask a lot of questions. When I was in school, I asked a lot of questions. When I'm looking at problems in school, it's the curiosity that develops those questions. When I'm in business, I look at situations and I try and understand how do they work, what makes this tick. I used to have a subscription to a fairly glossy magazine growing up in England. It's still around today, actually, called How It Works. And they just have features every week, from how do you make a ping pong ball, to how does a military tank work, to how does a spaceship work. And I love to know how do things work. I'm the sort of person that will take something and dismantle it, perfectly working functional thing, and dismantle it just to know. And put it back together because I want to know how it works. I'm the same with businesses as well. When I look at a business or a problem, I look at how does that work? Why does it work that way? What are the strengths and the weaknesses?
A lot of the things that I've learned from Louis as well, and just our collaboration, and then diving into these businesses, is that, to your point, that curiosity and the willingness to like ask questions. Sorry, there's a phone ringing in the background. And then the pattern recognition of kind of being a generalist, right? Like being a jack of all trades, maybe a master of none, but being able to like be curious, ask questions, apply learnings from one field to another, and then breaking these like seemingly complex, big initiatives into smaller, bite-sized things is a skill. And it's one that not everybody has, but one that you've honed through just years of practice and experience that comes very natural to you. But it obviously came at a cost in your developmental years and just trying to fit into a typical school environment, because that's really challenging, right? You're not able to retain information in the same way.
That's true. But you could look at the glass half full or half empty. Okay. I choose to look at it half full and realize that I have a probably highly developed EQ, emotional quotient, that allows me to assess situations, to take a step back, to breathe deeply and not panic in the situation, and look at a room, and it could be in a business situation, and decide, okay, that person over there, they really get the math, they get the logic of this. That person over there understands how all the pieces fit together. That person there probably doesn't get the big picture, but can really go deep in subject matter expertise in this area, and carry on and realize that no one person can get this done. But if we all leverage the strengths that we have and that we're offering together, the sum of the parts are definitely greater here. And often if somebody is too deep in one particular area, they can't see the trees there for the forest. And I think that's an ability and a skill that some people are born with, but I believe everybody else can develop and learn if they can pause, step back, and know how to evaluate these things. And I think in my career as a leader of organizations and teams, I've been able to help people take a deep breath, take that step, and categorize what's around them, what do they need to do to get this done. One of the big important challenges is when you address complex problems is dividing and conquering. And we heard Adam talk about this in the last podcast, where he was through the race, he was struggling, and you know what, there's only 170 miles to go. I mean, God bless you, my 170 miles, that's a long way to drive, let alone run. It's crazy. But if you think about the next aid station is only 30 miles away. Well, you know, 30 miles is still a long way to run, but 30 miles, I can comprehend 30 miles. Totally. I can have a plan for 30 miles. I can strap my feet up, put a new pair of clothes on so they're not hot and sweaty and I'm not chaffing, and I can make 30 miles. 170, I can't comprehend how to do that. It's the same in business. In business, I may not know how to achieve the end goal. It's really important. I know there is an end goal. I do need to make 170 miles over time, but right now I'm not going to worry about that. I'm going to worry about what is the next phase of the project and take one phase at a time, understand what those chunks are, what those milestones are, and make them along the way. I think that really helps.
Yeah. You know, Louis, one of my favorite questions that you ask, that you've asked of me sometimes, oh, well, almost every meeting that you and I have been in one-on-one, which always makes me pause, is what does success look like? And it's a simple question to ask. But if you're so stuck in the weeds and I'm talking about myself, if I'm so stuck in the weeds trying to like tell you about the tactical things that are going on, it's like that question in and of itself forces a stop and to think, okay, well, what does success truly look like for, maybe it's just a meeting or maybe it's a project or maybe it's a whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And then you can sort of think about, well, these things that I'm sharing or that I'm doing, do they really matter towards that end goal of what success truly looks like? And I just love that question that you ask, even though I dread it sometimes. But I remembered that actually in Moab, because the example you just shared was, you know, 170 miles to go and I'm 70 miles in at that point. And I'm like, well, what does success look like for me right now? And that was like, forget about the 170 miles. Well, I need to eat something. I need to drink something. I need to walk around the aid station and figure out, are my feet going to work? And if they are, that's successful. Then I can go on to the next thing. And so I just love how you're describing that in business, because it's so easy to get so caught up in the bigger things and the inertia of a big complex problem.
100% agree with you there. And it is really important to check yourself and take that step back and look at what does success look like in the short term. I do it with every meeting, like you said. The first time somebody said that to me, I went into a meeting and you said, how do I know this 60 minutes is a good use of my time? Tell me what success looks like at the end of this meeting. And I remember the first time I heard it, I was kind of offended. It's like, geez, which side of the bed did you get out of today? But actually, you're right. It is really powerful to always know and always understand that. I totally agree.
Yeah, it's been nice for me actually, because now I approach our meetings differently, you know, because I know you're going to want to know what that is.
Oh, yeah.
And it's important.
Yeah, and you can say it different ways. It's like, what are we trying to get done today? How do we know it's been good use of the time? There's many ways you can say it where you're a little less maybe obnoxious about it, perhaps. But yeah, it's definitely a good way of thinking about it. If I wind back to the genesis of Better, Faster, Further, BFF, part of it is where I've been coming from here. I was at the time a COO at Zynga, a gaming company. And we had recently gone public, which was awesome. And I was encouraged to take on a coach for myself. At that time, I was very proud. I don't need a coach. What do I need a coach for? Nevertheless, I was being encouraged time after time after time to get a coach. And I didn't think I really needed one. I've done pretty well on my own. Thank you very much. But I was told it's not for people who are broken. It's for people who are doing very well, but we just want to tune them up and make them even more successful. I interviewed a number of coaches, and whatever different version of this story you might hear, the true story is I chose Regan. He did not choose me. And I chose Regan to be my coach. And, you know, we could joke about just the other one wasn't very good or whether Regan was great, but I chose Regan. We had some goals that were set by the chief people officer and the CEO of Zynga. And we wrote those down and we talked about them a little bit. But we quickly realized as we were talking that, you know, I'm a little bit of this machine. I'm a little bit of execution. I mentioned that I've worked at the most senior levels at Oracle, reporting in at the most senior CEO level at Oracle. So I was all about execute, execute, execute. And while that was fine, I had another different CEO of a company I was working for tell me, after I told him I achieved 120% of quota, and he wasn't very happy. And he said, but okay, so what? And I said, so what? I got 120% of quota. He goes, listen, did you ever look over your shoulder? And I'm like, no. Well, what about this person and this person and this person? They're laying by the roadside dead. Well, yeah, I try to bring them along, but they just couldn't move quick enough and they couldn't think quick enough. And we had things to deliver. And hey, CEO, I got 120% of quota. He goes, I would have been happy with 100% because we already set aggressive goals, even if it was a little less, if you'd brought everybody along with you on this journey, because if you did, we would be stronger going forward because it's not you on your own being a superhero. And an expression and a phrase that I like to use a lot is superheroes don't scale. There's only one Spider-Man, there's only one Superman and Supergirl. These people don't scale. So yes, I got 100% of quota this time, but if we say, okay, now we're going to make it 150% of quota, can I do that or did I struggle at 120? If I had an extra few people, perhaps those people that were left on the roadside for dead with me, I might have been able to get 150 the next year or the next quarter. So it went to tell me that it's really important to take time to be patient and to bring people along with you on this journey. And it's not only about exceeding quota, it's about the journey that you take along the way there. So it's not all about execution. And when I met Regan, I was fascinated by this character. Regan was telling me about, well, what's the culture like? And who do you like to work with? And what are these people's, you know, hobbies? And what do they like to do for fun? And do you guys go and have an offsite where you talk about each other's families and friends and do falls of trust and how you feel? And, you know, emotions. I think I probably growing up had some emotions suppressed from being so, beaten up at school and intimidated both by my friend group as well as the teachers. And it was like, that was really interesting. And he and I came to realize that we're very different, as Regan said. He's very much about people, about culture, about well-being, about values. And I was very much about execute. And, playing and having feelings and fun is for when you're not at work. And even then, it's only if you've got time after work. And if you don't have time, then you keep working. And that was the way that I was programmed. And we came to realize when we analyzed the companies that Regan had worked with and the companies that I have worked with, that companies that only execute will have fairly high levels of attrition. Yes, people will be successful, but at some point they'll burn out. They won't be having fun anymore. They make money, but while we need to have a certain minimum amount to have a quality of life that we desire, it's not all about money. It's about the journey. And those companies have high turnovers. I don't deny the shareholders will probably make lots of money. They'll find new people to come in and execute. But that may not be the characteristics of a long-lasting company that we may want to work out or be associated with. I would argue with Regan, though, that if we have a company and we built it all in Regan's way, and I worked at a company just like this, I won't say the name here, we had a great time. We really enjoyed each other. We had very, very strict guidelines and boundaries between work and when we quit work, when we went to play. And it was a lot of fun. And I knew each other at a personal level very well. We hung out together a lot, etc. But you know what? Somebody out executed us. And that company is pretty much out of business. And a lot of those types of companies are. The huge aha that we had, which may seem somewhat simplistic, is wouldn't it be cool to build companies that have the enjoyment, the fun, the personal rewards and recognitions, and you're actually excited to go and hang out with the people you work with and know when to actually step back and breathe and enjoy your family, but at the same time, execute really well. And the trick is having the awareness, because often when we get into companies, we're working so hard that we don't even know what we're doing and why we're doing it, how we're doing it. We're just doing it. And Regan and I built the concept of Better, Faster, Further, and the programs that we built, whether it be the way we lead at offsites, the way we set company strategies, the way we coach and mentor and advise senior executives from young executives to industry veterans, it's having that heightened awareness of when's it right to really focus on people and culture to have a healthy organization? And when's it really right to say, you know what, now's the right time to heads down and execute the heck out of this. And even if it's just that next phase, that next milestone, that next chunk, that next exit gate to allow us to go into the entry gate of the next phase. And most importantly, a lot of the time, you just have to do both at the same time. It's not one or the other. You have to do both together. And how do you do that? And we thought, you know what, that's a really cool concept. And as Regan has said, his experience is very much as an outsider mentoring and guiding people through this from the outside. I personally have only ever worked inside companies for whatever I said, 40 something years, and never went to college or university and learned the theories. And if there's names for the things that I do, I just do it and have pattern recognition to do it. And we've been really excited to join these two forces and enable that to come out in the work that we do and the companies that we've helped along the way. And there is nothing more fulfilling than some of the organizations and people that we've worked with, where we began when it was a nascent company of a few people in a collab working space, to when they have an exit, whether it be a public offering or an acquisition offer, or even just meet their desire. They had a vision to deliver something to a particular market or service, and it's happened. And having that sense of fulfillment is so absolutely awesome. I want to make, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say one thing. I totally agree with that, Louie, and it's been...
You agree with me?
Yeah.
Regan and I don't agree, which is why we compliment each other. So I'm I want everybody to write this date down that Regan agrees with.
Yeah, we'll timestamp this recording here. No, it's been, you know, sometimes when I look back at, you know, we've been doing this together for almost 10 years. And, you know, I remember walking into your office in Zynga and all the Tottenham Hotspur memorabilia. I was like, oh, I like this guy already, because that was my favorite soccer team as well, just growing up. And but then when I look back at where we were then and where we are now, the myriad of leaders and companies that we've been a part of, I mean, when we go into these organizations, they kind of hand us the keys to the engine room and let us interview people. And we like we're in there, and it's just so fascinating, the lessons learned. And, you know, every company, regardless of size, even the darlings of Wall Street that look super shiny and sexy on the outside, they are a mess, complicated, dynamic under the hood. And, you know, when you put 10 people together to go build something or solve a problem, you know, it can get complicated. When you put 10,000 people together to try to build something or bring something to fruition, the dynamics and the communication and the egos and the personalities and the goals and the bureaucracy, like it's mayhem under the hood. And, so it's just been super fascinating. But I guess the point I'm trying to share is, it sounds cheesy, but like the ability to wake up in the morning and know that you're helping leaders become better leaders, teams become better teams, and companies scale is truly an honor. And it's a profound opportunity that I don't think any of us take for granted.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. It's a privilege to be able to be involved with that and to have the opportunity to see many different companies, many different people, many different organizations. And I'll speak for myself. You guys can speak for yourselves. I'm an old guy, but I love learning new things. And the privilege is getting to have a peek into all these different teams and organizations and continue learning. And even though I'm learning new things every day, we won't have time today, but I think this is a podcast on its own for a future date. There's a set of philosophies that I've used now and built and evolved over probably 30 years that I've found apply to companies that are tiny, companies that are huge, cultures from Americanized Western cultures. I've also used this, and I didn't mention I've built businesses and teams in, I think, 15 different countries now, a lot in Southeast Asia. And I've used these philosophies in Southeast Asia as well. So they're multicultural. I've used this in India. I've used this in China, etc. There's a philosophy of six attributes that are really important. I'll just rattle through them here, and maybe in a future podcast we can feature it. But this is philosophies that will without doubt make any company focused and successful if you implement them, commit to them, and incent and reward based upon them. Philosophy number one is taking risks in a business. One of the biggest killers is when people play it too safe. Philosophy number two is energy and enthusiasm that we bring to the work that we do and the work environment each and every day. Philosophy number three is accountability. Any business that is growing, that needs to run, whether it's tiny because there's not many people, or whether it's huge because there are so many people, accountability is critical. Accountability and ownership of who's got what, who's carrying which ball where, is really important. The next philosophy is metrics and measurements. It's really important to know how are we doing. And if we're doing things in a repetitive way, how can we do them better? And how can we move the needle further? So it's metrics and measurements. The next one is urgency. One thing I've learned as I've built businesses over the years is that every business is going to have copycats. It's going to have people who are going to be looking at you, maybe just getting going, looking at your experience of 3, 5, 10 years experience, and be able to take your tumbles and your falls and your lessons and maybe do it better. So you've got to have a sense of urgency to stay ahead. And then the final of the six philosophies I tout is productivity. We have to learn how to be more productive. One of the things that is always hard is, how do we measure developer productivity? How do we measure sales productivity, etc.? Knowing how to measure that so we can improve upon that is crucial. if you were really paying attention and I didn't say it, but the first letter of each one of those attributes that I just mentioned of philosophies spell the word team up. I call this philosophy team up, and they're my philosophies for consistent success. And if they're built and implemented and adhered to, you're going to have a much greater likelihood of success in the business than not. But it's got to take some discipline, some focus, and some hard work. And like I said, I've built this over the years, and it really has come from some of the adversity that I had to endure as a kid growing up, through those first jobs that I had, through to struggling my way, if you want. And at the time, I thought it was purely just hours and hard work through the leadership ranks, from programmer up to CEO and multiple C-level jobs that I've had over the years. And Team Up is really the culmination of all of those. And I do hope that we can focus on that in a future podcast.
Absolutely. I think it is worthy enough. I mean, we've done big presentations and conferences and conveyed that stuff, and it always gets really good engagement. So I think it'd be definitely worthy of doing. So Louis, one question I have that I think people would enjoy is kind of, you know, where you've taken us so far as this like corporate venture and kind of being this insider into the kind of the, you know, your version of the genesis of kind of Better, Faster, Further and your and my kind of partnership. You know, along that way, you've also had like some personal transformations. Like you used to be a worker bee, and you know, you work harder than almost anybody I know. So I'm not saying you're less of a worker bee, but you've had some personal, you know, health transformations and things like that. I'm wondering if you could, you know, give a little bit of, you know, share a little bit about what you're into these days and what that looks like, and you know, some of the, I guess, health and wellness and mindset stuff that you're working with today, because I think that's parallels to some of the stories that Adam and I have been sharing as well.
Yeah, sure. And I'm pleased you asked me that. So I would say that I was fascinated in my career, and I'll come to exactly what you said in a second, but as I looked up at the CEOs of some of these companies, big and small, that were leading the industry and leading thought in the industry a lot of the time, seemed to always have time to go follow their passions. Some of them went yachting, some of them went flying, some of them went mountaineering, and I just couldn't figure it out. I was working every hour, God sent, and weekends often, and then I would know that they were off sailing their boats. It was like, how do you do that? How do they get time to do that? Why do they do that? You know, they should be here with me working. And it took me a while to figure out that physical and mental health is one of the key aspects of being successful in business. And you need that time to be able to step back and regenerate, to think through difficult problems. Because yep. If you don't, you're going to get exhausted and burn out. And I actually, that happened. So in my personal situation, I got extremely overweight to the point where I had an executive physical and I was going through the motions, and then suddenly the doctors were running around me like crazy. They were swarming. My fellow executives at the company, there was one particular good friend, he was nearby and he came running up. What's going on? What's going on? Because all these white coats were running around me. And I had got very obese, had very high blood pressure, high cholesterol, everything you could say. And they were just freaking out. And it was a bit of a wake-up call for me. And whilst they didn't exactly say it, based on my family history, based on where I was, I probably was not going to be around for an extended period. You know, I don't know exactly when that meant, but it was a bit of a wake-up call for me. I was also getting pretty stressed, I guess, with the burden and with the workload, because as I took more work on and I was being more successful, I kept getting more piled on top of me until, you know, even when I felt I was Superman, I just wasn't, I couldn't expand anymore. I couldn't do anymore. There was only so many hours in a day. And a few things happened. One, I discovered mindfulness. And that was a game changer for me. I learned how to step away, sit down, make space for the present, push what happened in the last meeting or the last conversation or yesterday away, not worry about what was coming up next tomorrow, be totally not only present here, but make more space for the present time. If I can make more space for the present time, I can think about more complicated things, bigger things, and I can be more effective and impactful. And in fact, if I'm working with other people, more respectful because I'm really actually there with them in the moment, collaborating with them. And I've been practicing mindfulness and meditation now for, I would say, 10, 12 years. And I couldn't be more happy, to the point where, you know, even today, occasionally things may get a little bit much. I can stop, I can down my tools, I can just sit quietly, and I can do a body scan from top to bottom and enable myself to chill. And even, it's a bit of a party trick, I can even get my heart rate to drop as I'm doing it. I'm watching it dropping with a monitor. So that was one thing that was really important. But once I learned how to focus on the right things, I decided I needed to lose weight. I went to a boot camp. I saw some ads on Facebook that felt sleazy, but it kept coming up. I eventually went for an info session. I signed up. I lost around about 65 pounds worth of body weight. And in the process of doing that and maintaining that, somebody had said to me, hey, you should enter a race. You run pretty well, because a part of the program of the boot camp was we used to run around the parking lot in this industrial park. And I'm like, I'm not a runner. I can't do that. He finally convinced me to run a 5K at a turkey trot. And I was totally freaked out. I'd never run anything in my life like 5K. And I'd never showed up somewhere where you get a bib number and you have to pin it on, and there's thousands of people around me. But I did it at the turkey trot, and I had people in dinosaur costumes and strollers and stuff around me. Much to my amazement, the excitement of the situation, I ran 5K. I'd never run 5K in my life. And I got to the finish line and I'm like, already? I could do more. I could keep going. I was excited. I was able to do it. To today, I am able to trail run marathon distances and more, not quite Moab 240, a joke yet, that's probably ever. I mean, but for me, marathon distances feel like a long way. But I can tell you, forget the distance, whether somebody wants to run 5K or 1 mile or 240 miles, the value to self-development, self-care, self-appreciation, and the ability to deliver more in life and in business is immeasurable once you take care of yourself as your number one priority. I can't tell you how many times I tell clients I'm coaching, number one priority is yourself, number two is your family and loved ones, and then you can take care of business and everything else, because until those are settled, you can't take care of the others. When I'm up on the trails these days and I'm running, I am totally at peace. I can choose, and I often do have a list of things to think about while I'm running. And before I head out, I'll often pick off, okay, what problem am I going to solve or think through today? Sometimes it's big, sometimes it's small. Sometimes I'll make a little progress, sometimes I make a lot of progress. But I know when I'm up there in the hills or zoned out doing my running or my meditation, or maybe I'm going just for a hike and a walk, if that's what, you know, my ability or your ability might be, you can solve things there. And then I can come back and tackle those problems with a lot more effectiveness. And I'm happy to say I've maintained the minus 65 pounds, maybe it's actually 70 pounds now, ever since. And I'm happy with it. And I'm sort of proud of the level of health and fitness and the balance that I have between health and fitness and my professional life. And I'm happy to say that at Better, Faster, Further, I think we're all challenging ourselves to do this. Regan, yourself, you run the Double Dipsy, which is a challenging race. Adam does his Moab. I spoke to Lou yesterday. Lou has been working out, if you're not aware,
yeah, awesome,
two or three times a day for the past couple of weeks. So he's getting there. And I think as an organization, the BFF core team is performing at a higher level now professionally because we're focusing on our
personal health. Even in our weekly goals, we have, you know, our weekly commits, and then we have our personal commits, and those goals may be larger than a weekly audit, but just to make a public declaration that you're going to do something or focus on something. And, you know, there's built in accountability there, which is super cool, but it's been neat to see the transformation for you physically and emotionally as well. And, you know, I met you, prior to your running career, if you will, but it's like anything, you've been curious, you've done deep dives, you track everything. I mean, you're a total nerd now when it comes to this stuff, and a gear junkie. Yeah, exactly. You wear two watches and your Whoop and a Garmin and whatever. I can't even keep track. So I just find it awesome and hilarious at the same time. But that's great, Louis. I mean, I obviously with all of us, there's layers to it, but I think that's kind of an awesome overview, and hopefully gives folks a better sense. And some of those stories I hadn't even heard. Those details. I mean, I feel like I could do your intro 99.9% of the time if you weren't in the room, and probably vice versa. But every time we do it, it is a little bit different. And I think having the forum to actually do a deeper dive on that was fascinating. What else, if anything, is anything that you think is kind of just relevant to this conversation? Otherwise, I think we can continue to pick up and you know, we'll do a follow-up on the team up stuff, and super excited to have you continue to participate in these podcasts moving forward.
No, I think it's awesome. The only final parting thought, and you mentioned it briefly just to reemphasize it, different is good from a business perspective. So like you said, you and I are very different. You know, I'm the good-looking one, you're not, but that's okay. And because we're different, we blend and we complement each other. So your skills and your background are very different. The way you grew up, how you matured into the adult that you are today, is different to
me. They actually like
our professional experience,
the interactions.
That's very true. You're very likable, and I'm known as the bad guy. And I got to admit, I'm very direct, and I say it as it is. And I think people appreciate that.
But yeah, you're almost a nice guy. You're the half glass. You're the glass half full guy. But then you also are a self-proclaimed kind of pessimist. Maybe I don't know if that's the word you use, but no, there's a duality there, and I totally get it.
Indeed, and the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, any folks who are listening to this, different is good. You should be attracted by differences to see how you can complement and how the sum of the parts can be greater. Because I think the yin and the yang that we have is really helpful in building a complete rounded out picture. And us working as a team, and folks out there appreciate and value the differences that you see out in the world, and seek to understand, be curious about those differences, and seek to learn from them and improve who you are because of them. And I think I've learned from Regan, even though I'd never usually admit it. And I think he's learned from me too. And we're learning from Adam and his experiences that
Absolutely.
He's bringing to the team Absolutely. Since he's joined as well.
Well, Adam, any closing thoughts from you?
Not really. I've just been enjoying listening to Louis's story. I mean, there's a lot in there that I hadn't heard yet. I suppose I have one closing thought, and it's really from my own perspective, you know, about the reasons why I wanted to join Better, Faster, Further, the core team. And I think it is that diversity and those differences, because they make us stronger as a team. And we very much operate like a team, something that I've not ever experienced before in business, not to this level, in which we, you know, one of us may be working with a specific client, but that client may have a need that's outside of our sort of background or experience. And we will sort of plug in different people on the team based on what the client needs, and we'll collaborate and we'll work together and we'll share resources and share time and support each other. And it's really special to be part of something like that. And it's to take a step back and look at the impact of clients. I think it's incredibly valuable, and I know that they really appreciate it. I've had the direct feedback of how unique it is when they sign up to work with Better, Faster, Further, that they get a little bit of everybody.
It's definitely been an approach of ours, and
depending
something
on
that
what their needs
we
are.
Try to be explicit about is, you know, the companies that allow us to support them, we take very seriously, and it is a group effort, right? When you buy into BFF, you buy into a family approach, and, you know, they may need Regan on a Monday and Adam on a Tuesday and Lou on a Wednesday. And next week, a selling court or one of our coaches, or, you know, we have a very deep bench and a large extended family of quote unquote experts in a myriad of things that people scrub in and scrub out as needed. But it's really all about what Louis alluded to earlier, is just having the impact and understanding what success looks like and doing whatever it takes to help get them there. And oftentimes we don't get credit for it, and we're not in it to get credit. You know, we kind of claim that we're the SEAL Team 6 that oftentimes comes in under the shadow of night to help get stuff done. But that's awesome. I mean, the reward is in just seeing these leaders execute well and these companies, you know, grow and succeed. So, I would love to just throw it out there. Anybody that's listening to this, questions, comments, we would love to hear it. Any themes or challenges or opportunities you want to throw our way for potential podcast discussions, we would be happy to consider those. And in the meantime, if you can like or subscribe or send us some feedback or share it with your friends and colleagues, it would be immensely helpful. And if there's anybody you think that would benefit from some of the services or any of the themes that we talked about in this podcast, feel free to point them in our direction. We're happy to help any way we can, and no kind of opportunity or challenge is too big or too small for us. We'll take it on and consider it. And if we can't do it, we'll help point them in the right direction. But give us your feedback, like it, subscribe, and share it with others. And we really appreciate your time, Louis. Thank you. This was an awesome discussion. And Adam, always a pleasure, my friend. All right.
Great to see you guys.
You got it. Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys. Have a good day.